Hi, I'm Tawny Plattis, and I host the Dirty Bits podcast, a show where I very casually retell the sexy, scandalous, and salacious stories your teacher probably left out. We premiere a new episode every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Visit us at tawnyvoice.com/dirtybits to learn more. See you next Tuesday.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Ooh. Oh. And I am going to be talking to you about Dolores Huerta. Dolores was born April 10th, 1930, in the mining town of Dawson, New Mexico. She was the daughter of Juan Fernandez. He was a miner, a field and farm worker, union activist, and Alicia Chavez. And she spent most of her childhood actually in Stockton, California, where her mother raised her and her two brothers following her parents' divorce.
Uh-huh.
Her mother was known for her kindness and compassion towards others and was very active in community affairs, numerous civic organizations, the church. So she encouraged the cultural diversity that was a natural part of her upbringing in Stockton, California.
Yeah.
Her mother, Alicia, was a businesswoman. She owned a restaurant and a 70-room hotel where she welcomed low-wage workers and farm workers' families at affordable prices and sometimes gave them free housing.
Oh, good for her.
So Dolores was later very inspired by her mother as her life goes on, as I'm sure you will see.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Her community activism began when she was a student at Stockton High School. Dolores was active in numerous school clubs and was a majorette and a dedicated member of the Girl Scouts until the age of 18.
Yes, Girl Scouts.
Shout out to the Girl Scouts. Having lived life being marginalized as Hispanic, she grew up knowing that society needed to be changed. So after she graduated from high school in 1947, Dolores went through a marriage, the birth of two children, a divorce, and after a series of unsatisfying jobs, she eventually returned to school and attended college at the University of the Pacific's Stockton College, where she earned a provisional teaching credential. And she briefly worked at an elementary school, but she resigned because she was so distraught over the poor living conditions of her students, many of whom were the children of farm workers. Quote, I couldn't tolerate seeing kids come to class hungry and needing shoes. I thought I could do more by organizing farm workers than by trying to teach their hungry children. End quote.
Yeah.
So in 1955, she and Fred Ross started the Stockton chapter of the Community Services Organization, CSO. And that's a grassroots group that works to end segregation, discrimination, and police brutality, improve social and economic conditions of farm workers.
Right.
Fred Ross often delegated huge responsibilities to her as they ran the CSO. He knew she was capable of delivering the organization's message and promoting its agenda. So as she resumed responsibilities and stance that were traditionally held by white males, Dolores, of course, encountered criticism both on gender and ethnic stereotypes.
Right.
I mean, go figure.
Right.
In 1960, Dolores started the Agricultural Workers Association. She set up voter registration drives, lobbied politicians to allow non-U.S. citizen migrant workers to receive public assistance and pensions, and provide Spanish language voting ballots and driver's tests.
Ugh.
During this time, she met Cesar Chavez, a fellow CSO official who had become its director. In 1962, both Dolores and Chavez lobbied to have the CSO expand its efforts to help farm workers, but the organization was really focused on urban issues and couldn't move in that direction.
Oh, okay.
So frustrated, they left the organization and with Gilbert Padilla founded the National Farm Workers Association. Chavez was the dynamic leader and speaker, and Dolores the skilled organizer and the tough negotiator.
Yes.
Talk about a first lady.
Yes.
The foundation was later changed to an affiliated agricultural workers organization.
Mm-hmm.
And through the organization, Dolores helped to champion for the rights of workers in agricultural fields to ensure that they were well paid and worked in better conditions. In 1965, the AWA and the NFWA combined to become the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee, which later is just simply United Farm Workers.
Yes.
Dolores directed the UFO's national boycott during the Delano grape strike, taking the plight of the farm workers to the consumers. She led the organization of boycotts advocating for consumer rights. The boycott resulted in the entire California table grape industry signing a 3-year collective bargaining agreement with the United Farm Workers in 1970.
Monumental.
Mm-hmm. In addition to organizing, Dolores has been active in lobbying for laws to improve the lives of farm workers. The laws that she supported included a 1960 bill to permit Spanish-speaking people taking the California driver's examination in Spanish, 1963 legislation to extend the federal program aid to families with dependent children to California farm workers, and the 1975 California Agriculture Labor Relations Act. As an advocate for farm workers' rights, Dolores has been arrested 22 times for participating in nonviolent civil disobedience activities and strikes. She remains active in progressive causes and serves on the boards of People for the American Way, Consumer Federation of California, and Feminist Majority Foundation. Her honors are just too numerous to list them all. We're just going to hit the highlights.
Sure.
She was named one of the three most important women of the year in 1997 by Miss Magazine. She was the inaugural recipient of the Eleanor Roosevelt Award. That same year, Ladies Home Journal recognized her as one of the 100 most important women of the 20th century, alongside women such as Mother Teresa, Margaret Thatcher, Rosa Parks, and Indira Gandhi. On May 18, 2007, she announced her endorsement of Hillary Clinton for president, and at the 2008 Democratic National Convention, Dolores formally placed Clinton's name into nomination.
Wow.
She received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama on May 29, 2012. She is an honorary chair of Democratic Socialists of America and currently serves on the Board of Directors of Equality in California. In October 2010, she was awarded an honorary degree by Mills College, who lauded her as, quote, a lifetime champion of social justice, whose courageous leadership garnered unprecedented national support for farm workers, women, and underserved communities in a landmark quest for human and civil rights.
Amen. Talk about, just like we did Gloria Steinem last week, where we were like, talk about women who are still alive, and people are like, mm-hmm. Who's that?
Yeah, but I don't think I've ever heard of her. If I did, it's in passing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even more of when people ask, you know, are you ever going to run out of women? No, there's Never. Women still alive that are changing the world that myself, as a modern feminist who loves researching things,
right,
doesn't know about. And so, no, we're not.
Never. Yeah, absolutely. No, Dolores is one of the most influential women that is still alive today, a voice that has been just as strong. And it's really kind of amazing when you think about how long she's been an activist, mm-hmm. especially yeah. these days in the hard media environment that we live yep. in these days. For her to still be kicking it and still be activisting is something else. Something else. So I'm going to be talking about Eleanor of Aquitaine, one of the most badass queens from history. And I didn't really know most of this story before. So Eleanor is honestly one of the most powerful women of her age. She's born most likely around 1122 in what is now southern France to William X, who was the Count of Poitou and the Duke of Aquitaine, and Eleanor de Châtellerault. She had one brother, William, who died in infancy, and one sister, Petronilla, who was born in 1125 and survived into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
She had a relatively normal upbringing. The court that she was living in as she was growing up was very bright and lavish. She would have had a very good education, not only in arts and government, but also in running a household and how to sew and how to embroider things. So she was kind of given a really well-rounded education for the time that she's living in. I mean, we're talking about the 12th
yeah.
century here.
Yeah.
Now, her mother dies in 1130, and despite not having a male heir, William did not remarry. He either fell ill or he died of contaminated drinking water, actually not long after, and bequeathed all of it to Eleanor when he died in 1137.
Wow.
Though not before telling his friends to approach King Louis VI of France about the possibility of his son, Louis VII, marrying her, which is exactly what happened. So Eleanor and Louis VII were married in Bordeaux on July 25th, 1137. This isn't exactly something that is perfect. The king at the time is not exactly sure of this marriage because the lands that come with Eleanor mm-hmm. are really far away from where they are at the moment. Right. They were afraid that it might be unwieldy to defend or hard to keep in the kingdom, but it ended up happening anyways. And actually just 7 days after the wedding, Louis VI dies of dysentery. So at 16 and 15 years old, respectively, Louis and Eleanor become the king and queen of France.
Whoops.
Which is not an age that anyone should be given control of anything. So Louis apparently is not the best king. Before his brother Philip died, he had actually intended to become a monk. He becomes infatuated with Eleanor, but he's not really that big of a king or a husband. At least Eleanor is said to not be very happy about it, as evidenced by the fact that it takes her 8 years to have their first child in this marriage.
Oh boy.
Right. So apparently he was deeply in love with her and she was just kind of
meh
about him. She upset Pope Innocent when she and Louis supported her sister Petronilla when she entered into an affair with Count Raoul of Vermandois, who was married at the time to the sister of Count Theobald of Champagne. The Pope actually sided with Theobald and excommunicated Louis, Raoul, and Petronilla, which began a war between the two sides, although Louis was reinstated after being deeply affected by the burning of a cathedral with some 1,250 people inside of it. And it
Holy
was shortly
mackerel.
After that Eleanor had their first daughter.
That's like a third of the population at that time.
Yeah.
What?
So they go into this war and he goes, oh, never mind, I'm not into this.
I didn't want to be president.
Exactly. Unfortunately, Eleanor gives birth to a daughter instead of to a man. And it doesn't secure the spot because at this point, of course, women cannot ascend to the throne. So over his guilt in his role in the war, Louis and Eleanor decide to go on crusade. Now, Eleanor insisted that she join him on the crusade, which was incredibly dangerous because she believed that her involvement would please God and then result in the birth of a male child. So she's doing it because she wants a boy and he's doing it because he's guilty over this war that he had against the Pope. She held tournaments to attract knights to the cause and is believed most of the crusading army was comprised of her vassals. However, the crusade really didn't end up going well, and Eleanor and Louis grew increasingly estranged. And after several really bad years between the two of them, Eleanor actually sought an annulment from Louis, which was groundbreaking. No woman had ever tried to use the rules of the church to get out of a marriage they didn't want to be in before. This was something that only men had done in the past. So they weren't really quite sure how to do it. And it took them a while, but eventually they were granted the annulment on the grounds of something called consanguinity, which means that they were related by blood. And at this time, it wasn't just like these days they say it's weird to marry someone second cousins. Here you couldn't marry someone if you had one relative in common 7 generations back. And so they had a relation that was 3 generations back, and the Pope went, I see what you're doing, but you can have the annulment.
Right.
Within 2 months of her annulment, she goes to marry Henry, Count of Anjou, Duke of Normandy. She goes to marry Henry, which is a little bit controversial at the time because they also had relatives in common that were like 1 generation back.
Ooh.
But the marriage went along anyways. And then 2 years later, when King Stephen dies, Henry arises to the throne. So now it's Henry and Eleanor as king and queen of England instead of France.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Eleanor bears 5 sons over 13 years to Henry, although their relationship was tumultuous at best. Henry was a philanderer and cheated on her constantly. And
see, that was my role.
Eleanor was not necessarily faithful to it either. But you know what? If they're both going to be, then
equality.
Exactly. The extent of Eleanor's role in Henry's rule is largely unknown, although it seems unlikely that a woman of her energy and education would have been wholly without influence, like she wouldn't have had a voice. There's no real record of her having an effect on the day-to-day machinations of everything until she separates from Henry in 1167 and moves her household to her own lands in Poitiers, back in Aquitaine.
Mm.
There's really no documentation as to why the marriage falls apart, or most people trace it back to Henry and all of the people that he was sleeping with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Eleanor's time as mistress of her own lands in Poitiers, back in Aquitaine, is where we get all of the stories of chivalry and the court of love and men trying to woo noble, wealthy women by doing heroic acts and trying to win their love and their favor and their patronage through slaying dragons. So this all happens between 1168 and 1173. And 1173 is really where things start to go downhill for Eleanor for quite a long time, because Eleanor's younger son, who is also named Henry, actually flees to France, apparently plotting against his father so that he could seize the English throne. Eleanor is also rumored to have actively supported her son's plans against her estranged husband, primarily because she was angry that what she got in the divorce, she was supposed to get more power than what the king actually gave her, which is also apparently the rumor as to why the sons wanted to rebel, because the sons were also promised power by the king, and the king just couldn't bring himself to split with any of his power.
If you haven't watched The Lion in Winter, if you want to see Catherine Hepburn be Eleanor of Aquitaine.
She's captured. She's held in prison for 16 years, which for someone who is as active and amazing as she is, to be entrapped for 16 years, can you even imagine? Eventually, years after the rebellion and revolt, young Henry finally succumbed to disease in 1183 and actually died begging on his deathbed for his mother's release. Henry, under guard, released her and actually allowed her to return to England in 1184, after which she rejoined his household for at least part of each year, joining him on solemn occasions and actually resuming some ceremonial duties as queen. So they didn't really get a divorce. They got a divorce in almost everything but the actual papers of the divorce. Mm-hmm. She was still queen. She was just having her court down over in Poitiers. Henry died finally in July 1189, and their son Richard succeeded him, Richard the Lionheart from Robin Hood. Richard, of course, goes off on his fabled crusades, and Eleanor rules England in her son's stead for much longer than she actually originally intends to. He didn't intend to go away for as long as he did, but he ends up going away for more than 10 years. And by the time he comes back, she's kept the entire place running. And one of the documentaries I watched in preparing to do her, the same documentary I watched for when we did Matilda last year.
Yeah.
And it's talking, they call it She-Wolves. And they're talking about how, when would a woman be able to take power in her own right? And Eleanor really becomes the first example of a woman holding her own in the position of the head of state in her time period. Matilda had failed because she was trying to do power in her own right, whereas Eleanor was ruling on behalf of her son.
Right.
And so she was allowed to hold court and, and be there. Because I guess that was acceptable.
It's not really me.
Exactly.
It's not really me.
Exactly. So she lived long enough to actually see Richard die and her youngest son, John, crowned king after his death. And she was actually employed by John as an envoy to France. And it's during this time she continued to travel extensively. Some estimates sit at 1,000 miles that she traveled before her death at 77 years old in 1204.
What a life.
Right? Absolutely amazing woman. And also another woman whose career and whose achievements are much more than what we could cover here on the podcast. So we'll continue, just like we've done every week, linking to various accomplishments and successions. Hey, friends. If you're enjoying this podcast, do Allison and myself a favor and go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. There we put deleted scenes, bloopers, pictures, all kinds of fun stuff. And you get the pleasure in knowing that what you hear every Monday morning, you're helping to create. Once again, that's patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
If you're enjoying this podcast, you can do something quick. Easy, look down at your phone, whatever platform you're listening on, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe, whatever you can do, because those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.
All right. So this week we're going to do another literally
in today in herstory,
where we are talking about things that are affecting us today. So today we're going to be talking, in honor of Dolores Huerta, we're going to be talking about
unions.
Unions. And in particular, how the farm workers and how unions throughout history have helped us get to where we are today.
Mm-hmm. I think that unions at the moment seem to have a little bit of a bad reputation, which is unfortunate. And I'm not quite sure where that attitude comes from. But it seems to be like they're big and bad, and
right.
like they're corporations sort of in their own right,
right,
which I don't think is accurate, or it definitely is right. not the way that they are intended to be used or to be set up. But I think really the important thing for us when we're talking about unions today is to just think about how many unions are often founded by women or started by women or co-founded or run by women, because a lot of the social change that we see in our society and in our country is fought for by single women. Again, you can read All the Single Ladies by Rebecca Traister. She goes into this, so I'm going to not remember all of the dates and times and everything exactly accurately.
Right.
But essentially, there are many, many movements and unions that were started by women just simply saying, this is unfair and I cannot support myself or my family or live a respectful and decent life
yeah.
with the wages that I'm being paid or the hours that I'm being worked. And this is not okay. And had the courage to stand up and fight for unions and
yeah.
for change. And a lot of that also comes from just women workers in the garment industry, you know, the shirtwaist fire factory.
Absolutely.
Or factory fire was a big turning point for a lot of people as well, and that primarily affected women. Is that because hopefully as a society, when we see that women and children are hurt or affected by something, they tend to garner more sympathy?
Well, I think unions have come from a long history of the Industrial Revolution basically taking advantage of anyone and anything they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really see unions coming into being until the end of the Industrial Revolution. We see all of this growth, 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 growth. And then finally, people start realizing that they have the power, that if the people who run the means of production aren't going to listen to those who are actually doing the producing, then the people doing the producing have the power to stop them if they all get together.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. And unions do a lot of things where they get to collectively bargain. You have a stronger voice when you're all together. You have the power to stand up and say, no, we want better working conditions, better and safer working conditions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons we see the decline today in unions is honestly the power of business in our politics.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina, for example, is what is known as a right-to-work state, which is an anti-union mm-hmm. law that legislatures pass. And they don't outlaw unions because you can't, because freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do instead is they say that it is illegal for a union to require membership in the union in order for you to work at a specific place. You have a right to work wherever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does, it dilutes the power of the union
right.
to where people are getting the benefits of the union without actually paying into the union or participating in the running of the union.
Right.
And what it's done is it's helped to degrade a lot of the workers' rights that we have in this country. It used to be that I think it was something like 80 to 90% of all workers in the United States in the 50s and 60s were unionized. And what it allowed was for a strong middle class where you could
support a family on one income.
Exactly. You could support a family on one income. It's one of the reasons why Hollywood is as strong and influential and prosperous as it is, because literally everyone here is unionized once you get into the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it helps. It's, I think, one of the reasons why we're seeing now that the Me Too movement has really taken off. It's because actresses in Hollywood and all of the different people who work in the different unions, they understand the power of the collective. They understand mm-hmm. the power of, if we all get together and say, we're not going to deal with this anymore, then change has to happen. Change has to be forced upon people
mm-hmm.
sometimes. Not always, but sometimes.
Well, I mean, it's just kind of like the women in Iceland walking out. If you
yeah.
say, oh, well, you're not going to give me, you know, a safe space to make all your shirts in. Well, you
right.
don't have any shirts to sell now. So
exactly. Yeah.
And come at me.
So what Dolores did when they started the Farm Workers Union was to take all of these people who were living in the shadows, living illegally, living in really quite squalid conditions, and say, listen, we're all going to get together and we're going to fight for all of us at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it forces a change. Look at everything that Dolores Huerta has been able to do in her life.
It's incredible.
And it is through the power of unions that she was able to do that. I mean, to some extent, you can also call what Gloria Steinem did unions as well, bringing people together to collectively bargain for a change, for something that they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
You change the world right where you're standing. If your place of business has a union and you've not joined, join. If the union is not good, work to change it from the inside. Don't try to get rid of the union. Join the union and change it for the better.
Like a lot of the topics that we talk about, this is also one where it's important to do a little bit of research, a little bit of reading, and find out what a union actually does, one that you maybe are considering joining or that is being talked about in a local vote, a local election, because your local unions, again, that's where you're going to see change.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we talk about our cause of the week?
Yes, please.
So this week, obviously, we are going to be talking about the Dolores Huerta Foundation. And as we sort of mentioned in our episode, the Dolores Huerta Foundation is a 501c3, so it's a community benefit organization that organizes at the grassroots level, engaging and developing natural leaders, creates leadership opportunities for community organizing, leadership development, civic engagement, and policy advocacy in the following areas: health and environment, education and youth development, and economic development. Quote, our mission is to create a network of organized, healthy communities pursuing social justice through systemic and structural transformation. End quote.
Amen. So you can find their website at Dolores Huerta, that's DoloresHuerta.org.
Check it out.
Yes. So I think that's it for another episode of The Bitchery of History. If you would like to continue keeping in contact with us, you can find us on Facebook at The Bitchery of History.
Twitter is at Bitchery Podcast.
And Instagram is The Bitchery of History.
We could not make these episodes happen without our incredible team. So thank you to Jeanette,
Kim,
Sydney,
and Jess.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.